You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Well, hello, Derek and Danny of the American Prestige Podcast. Welcome to the Non-Zero Podcast, unless it's the other way around and I'm joining
Fancy
you.
Fancy seeing you here.
Yeah.
One way or the other.
Hi, Bob. I think we're joining you. I always felt this as you're accepting us. You're the podcast godfather.
you're bringing us in.
You're bringing us into your circle.
Yeah.
You're practicing cognitive empathy with us and bringing us in.
I'm doing my best to spread the word. So, you know, one thing that people who listen but don't watch miss, Danny, is your Grim Reaper outfit. Are you always dressed like that?
Super early here. So whenever I'm recording a podcast, it's only 8:30 on the beautiful Pacific Northwest, not coast, but in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. So it's always a little chilly. So oftentimes I put on a hoodie because this is punk rock. Podcasts are punk rock, Bob. That's the truth of them.
Is that right?
They don't make money. They're cheap to produce, and there's a lot of them.
You should write that piece if you haven't already.
It's in print somewhere. I've said it somewhere, maybe in an interview.
So, you know, one thing about doing these only every 2 months, which is our habit, is that a lot happens in between. I think since we last spoke, I think the Assad regime has fallen, and I suspect that by the time we next speak, Greenland and Panama will both be in American hands where they belong.
Properly returned to America, yes.
And we spoke before the election, right? I mean, that's the biggest one. We spoke before the election, I think, last time. Or did we speak after the election?
It would have been,
right around.
So we have a whole new president since?
It might have been right around, but we didn't get into the good Trump stuff. So are you afraid? Is Trump 2.0 spiking fear within you? Like Trump 1.0?
You know, it's funny. I mean, Trump derangement syndrome, I'm starting to wonder whether it's really a mental illness. I mean, it's like, I think maybe it's time to get pretty deranged about this guy. I don't know. Can you tell me, is this like a whole new kind of weirdness? I mean, the Panama and the Greenland thing. I mean, at one level, I think it's like Trump saying a weird thing, it gets headlines, and so he keeps repeating it. Like, that's his MO. But there's obviously a little something more going on here, especially with Greenland, it seems like to me, right?
Well that's the thing going back a couple hundred years. I mean, like, you have U.S. politicians, I believe, going back to Andrew Jackson, talking about acquiring Greenland. I think an attempt is made, if I'm remembering correctly, in the 1860s. So this is actually kind of like, this is, to me, the most interesting part about Trump when we're talking in the realm of ideology, that he does harken back to a pre-World War II era of foreign policy thinking that just seems like totally strange in our world today. For example, the United States effectively doesn't run Greenland, but it makes the use of Greenland that it needs with military base. So you don't need to own Greenland like you did in the 1860s to do that. You just have your military. What's strange about Trump is that he just wants the sort of 19th century territorial expansion. You don't need it. You know, like the liberals say you don't need it.
This is not how we do empire these days, Donald.
Exactly.
We already have Greenland. We have a military base there. The only thing that could go wrong is to get the natives all pissed off.
Right. So this is what's funny to me is you have like the liberal establishment being like, oh, my God. But they just like the empire we have, the sort of more cloaked empire, like Daniel Immerwahr's book, How to Hide an Empire. They don't like the 19th century. You go in and you send troops and you physically acquire it. So there's a kind of like funny little irony there. It's like, Donald, you don't do it. We already control them. And that is what I think is most interesting about Trump is this really old style thinking that just seems it is so atavistic and out of place for a 21st century liberal empire.
I think he's also got people in his ear telling him that we need to exploit Greenland's rare earth deposits.
Definitely,
although,
vis-a-vis China. Yeah.
If we get to that point where they can be exploited, I think half the planet's going to be underwater, so we're probably going to have bigger fish to fry than exploiting
rare
earth.
Is that true? I mean, it sounds like you know more about them. Are they so deeply buried?
I don't know. I don't know. But, I mean, there's so much ice covering Greenland. I have to assume that to get at the rare earths, like, some of that ice is going to have to be melted away or it will have to have gone away to get at it. Maybe not. Maybe that's not true. But
I don't know.
I just feel like it's a little bit dicey to me. Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of which, you know, these screen share things never work, but I mean, they look weird on YouTube, but I got to do this with you guys. So I'm going to give you I'm going to give you a quick screen share.
Because, oh, hell yeah. I love it.
This
nice
is a picture
of
my daughter in Greenland.
Oh, cool. Atop,
maybe at the highest point. It's like the great, most famous glacier. But anyway, you know, she was there as a Fulbright scholar. And I think maybe that, in retrospect, is part of the early warning system that America has a place in its sights.
She did her Fulbright in Greenland?
Yeah, it just opened up.
Science?
I mean, it just opened up in a weird way. And she thought, oh, cool. And
like science work? Is that like what
she's
did she
in
do
the
there?
Humanities. She had already been to Russia teaching. And that was, so anyway, long story, but I need to get figure out a way to stop sharing. Okay. I don't know. I'm a little more worried this time. I mean, I assume this issue will kind of go away. Tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I do think the way he's acting signifies kind of what we had worried about, which is that he's going to be feeling his oats more, less constrained by the blob, and yet, you know, older and crazier.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the Greenland thing in theory could happen, but I believe one would probably have to expend a lot of political capital, time, and attention on it. And that just hasn't been Trump's historical trademark. I think what is going to be interesting, assuming that the idea that he has, quote unquote, learned from his first term is correct, which I don't necessarily think it is. We'll have to see. If he has learned, then it'll be interesting to witness the degree to which the American state is in the hands of someone like Trump. To what degree is the machinery of state just difficult to use, actually? Difficult to point in particular directions? To what degree does bureaucratic inertia, institutional inertia, actually shape things? So if it is true that Trump is more capable, which, again, I don't want to concede because he might just be like older, more tired, more lazy. But if it is true, we'll be able to see to what degree you could actually move the ship of state.
I don't know. Derek, are you... You're feeling calm and rested?
I'm not, actually. No, I mean, I think the problem that I see is not so much that he's actually going to try to get Greenland into the U.S. or that he's going to make Canada the 51st state or seize control of the Panama Canal. But the fact that, you know, Danny and I were talking about this earlier, if you're the president or the president-elect, as opposed to the ex-president or ex-game show host who just talks about politics, rants about politics sometimes. When you're the president, even the stupid shit that you say means something and people have to respond to it as though, you know, there's some weight to it. And that is destabilizing in and of itself to have the U.S. president talking about. I don't even know what, I mean, he wouldn't rule out, the other day he got asked if he would rule out using military force to take Greenland, which is the territory of a NATO ally. And he said, no, I can't rule that out. So like, what?
But that's
what,
just also his madman thing, right? Like, his theory
the madman
of
thing, like turning the madman thing on like the closest treaty ally.
Imagine the U.S. attacking a treaty NATO ally.
How better to signify your madness? I mean, you know, if people don't know, this is the famous theory. It goes back to Richard Nixon that, hey, you want to act a little crazy. Then everybody figures, hey, he might nuke us and they'll behave. And
Trump has said this a few times, right? This is not just like me. He has said this is how one negotiates, that you come in with like a very extreme position and then you see. And to me, a lot of it can be read through that. I mean, because it just needs time and
attention. Isn't this the guy who went bankrupt running a casino and like never pays any of his subcontractors? Like, why are we listening to his business advice, really?
That's not very good advice. It's also impressive to go bankrupt running a casino.
Yes, absolutely.
Also worry a little that this kind of has a normative effect when you have 4 years of an American president talking casually about, you know, just basically violating the borders of any sovereign nation that we feel we'd kind of like to, you know, have a little piece of. It kind of adds up. I mean, I take, you know, norms seriously, including the norm of not invading countries. That's why, you know. The Russian invasion of Ukraine was a very, very regrettable thing, even though I thought better American policy could have prevented it in the first place. And I worry about that. And I worry about, look, tell me if I'm getting, well, we know I'm getting old. Even you guys are getting old. But
We're
tell me if
way.
This is like an old guy. But the whole normative aura of Trump and Musk. It's like we have young kids growing up and they're just entering that malleable period where, you know, their character's being shaped. And you say, oh, well, that's the president of the United States. That's the richest guy in the world. And he's done all this great shit. And they're both fucking, you know, completely lawless in a thoroughgoing sense of the word. They have no respect for just the rules that have governed society and in the best of times have governed the whole world, although they haven't very often been effective in the whole world. But just the idea of respecting.
Well, I mean, those norms are gone. I mean, you're not going to bring them back. Once norms go away, they're very difficult to bring it back because they no longer reflect the political, economic, material realities on the ground. So to me, it's just a reflection of the total failure of liberalism. Liberalism has failed to reconstitute itself in its generation, which is ironic because one of the things that liberalism has historically been very good at is reconfiguring itself. There's a very famous article by Gary Gersel titled The Protean Character of American Liberalism. And what it essentially traces over the course of centuries is that liberalism is able to incorporate its critique over time. When the populists criticize it and then incorporates the populists. When you need to actually run the state, it makes the New Deal. When you need to fight World War II, you actually create a defense industrial base. And there are problems with all of these things, but has been able to incorporate the critique. So to me, the interesting question is less the end of the norms, which is obviously that's done, that you're not going to put that.
No, I really disagree. I'm talking about the norm of like not invading countries. And I'm not saying it's in perfect shape, but nobody, you know, it's been
the United States has just never done that. I mean, like, just as a pure empirical matter, the United States has just never respected that norm since the creation of international institutions in the middle of the 1940s. It just never has. I mean, there's like a lot of qualitative research now coming out in the last. Have you read Dying by the Sword by Sadita Kushi and Monica Duffy Tuff? It's really useful. The United States intervened more in the era of international institutions than at ever any previous time in its history, tried to covertly overthrow a regime 66 times. So I think it's worth questioning. These weren't real norms.
Well, I mean, first of all, the nature of the violation of sovereignty has changed. It's been a very long time since the U.S. actually acquired and kept territory by force. And I would just say, since the end of the Cold War, I don't think anyone has seriously entertained the possibility that the U.S. would do that, certainly in the Western Hemisphere, like actually invade and take over and say, this is ours now. This is our territory now. I think that norm was actually shaping up pretty nicely for a while. And by the way, I want to emphasize, look, I said this a ton of times. We had the opportunity after the Cold War to really establish the global norm of respecting the law against invading countries. And we screwed up because we didn't respect it ourselves. Kosovo was illegal. Iraq was illegal and so on. I've said that a billion times. We screwed up. We're the ones who screwed up. Still, the post-Cold War period has been normatively different than much of human history in the sense of what kinds of things the U.S., anyone would dream of the U.S. doing. And one thing they would not have dreamed of it doing is actually acquiring territory by force. And Trump is now talking about that. No president has talked about that in my lifetime. And we have a president who's talking about that. Well, and he's a nut, but the world doesn't like, you can't just disassociate yourself from him. You know, he's the president.
But then the question is, why did the U.S. do that? Why after 1989 did no one talk about that? And it's because the U.S. didn't need to run the empire that way. So that's the question, right?
Right.
It's just we're talking
just
about
saying,
different
that's a
forms.
Change. That's a change.
Oh, it is a change. Well, it's a return. Yeah, I would say it's a return.
It's a change in norms if you no longer do it the old fashioned way.
Yeah. I mean, there were always worries, as you know, within the United States in particular, about giving up sovereignty, going back to the League of Nations debate, which the Senate didn't, you know, approve. The United States didn't join the League of Nations. So this is like a deep-seated American thing. And in some sense, it's a return to the American norm. What might be viewed in 100 years as sort of the strange period is this Cold War, post-Cold War moment.
But just to drill down on that and be clear, yes, the American fear of having its own sovereignty violated by, you know, in any number of ways, including in serious involvement in international institutions, is one big thing that has kept the U.S. from establishing the global norm against violating national sovereignty. That's kind of an irony, but it is the case because we have been unwilling to surrender our own right to bomb countries when we feel like it. And
we also do control five territories that don't have rights. Let's not forget that. And we have controlled them for well over a century. So there's also a lot going on there.
So wait, list them all. I've forgotten
American Samoa, Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, Guam, and U.S. Virgin Islands. Five populated territories that don't have rights. This is Daniel Immerfahr again in the How to Hide an Empire book really talks about it. But like, even though these aren't large territories, et cetera, there's something revealing there, in my opinion, that they have not been granted political rights.
We have, as I said, we have a kind of empire, and that's the least of it in a way. I mean, you know, that's a very small fraction of our military bases around the world. So anyway, I don't know. Derek has been pensive. I'm sure he can weigh in with shattering insight.
I'm not sure I can, actually. I mean, I think, Bob, I agree with you that the moment, if there was a moment to instantiate a real respect for international laws and the rules of the rules-based order, we're the ones, the United States is the one that allowed that moment to fritter away. Because it's always been the case that we view international law as something that applies to the little people and not to us. And even the reason that we changed the rhetoric from respecting international law to talking about the rules-based order is because nobody knows what the rules are. We're the keeper of the rule book, and we get to make that up as we go along. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with that.
Which we've stopped talking about after Gaza, according to Trita.
Yeah, we don't even talk about that anymore. Yeah, I mean, that to me, I mean, what Gaza represents is just a complete, you know, we've set fire to the whole thing.
That's a real violation of norms.
Nothing coming back. Yeah,
that's a violation of norms. Yeah, that's setting fire to the entire thing. And I think it's much as Los Angeles is burning right now, the rules-based international order is itself also burning. And so the question is, how does one reconstitute itself? And I don't think anyone has the right answer to that. I don't think the right does. I don't think the liberals do. And the left don't have power. So here we are.
By the way, you mentioned Trita Parsi. And I would encourage people to check out my conversation with him on this podcast feed. It's relevant to this because Quincy did this big, long project and an ensuing report about how you would build, if the moment were propitious, which nobody thinks it is, you would rebuild and reform international institutions. And it's visionary and very much worth, I think, Better Order Project is what you could Google to find
it. I signed on to it. I'm one of the
Oh, that's right. I saw your name. And I'm like, oh, my God.
They're letting anyone in here.
This is like much less nihilistic than we generally expect from Danny. What's going on? Where's the Grim Reaper I know who says it's all hopeless? And
climate disaster might engender some. I mean, like this is the I don't know, Bob, I'm sure you're a big fan of comic books, but like in the Alan Moore graphic novel Watchmen, his whole theory of the case is you need an external authority to engender human cooperation. You know, an external threat, not an authority. Maybe that'll happen with climate.
Well, yeah. Or, I mean, I think if we get the picture, it'll happen with AI. But that's the opposite is happening so far, which is we think it's a reason to further deepen antagonism with China.
Well, capital is nowhere else to go, right? Crypto is not real. The NFTs aren't real. There's actually nowhere to really invest anymore because you're not building the United States. So it has to go to something like AI. So the problem with AI is capitalism, in my opinion. If you're worried about AI, where else is capital going to go? It has to reduce labor costs in the white-collar workforce. That's what AI is doing.
But I would just point out that contributions to the Non-Zero Foundation, which runs this podcast and the Non-Zero Newsletter, are tax deductible. So there is one place you can put capital that...
The only place.
...will probably do about as well as Bitcoin. Yeah. So I'm sorry. You mentioned Gaza. Well, first, historical footnote. In our failure, in my view, to seize the post-Cold War moment. And I think, Danny, you're too young, I think, to appreciate how much norm-shaping power the U.S. had. It was unbelievable. We were on top of the world. And the funny thing is, George W. Bush, he did have kind of the right instinct. You know, he had been ambassador to the U.N. He started taking the U.N. seriously. He went to the UN and authorized the Persian Gulf War. So it was a legal war. Security Council okayed it. But, you know, ironically, you know what the, I mean, in light of recent events, you know what the big blemish on his record is? A little trivia question in this regard. He invaded Panama. He invaded Panama and seized because we wanted to, because it was politically convenient to seize their leader.
Yep.
Who was involved in drug smuggling.
Yeah. And then there's also stuff about like what his team said to Saddam Hussein. I mean, there's HW is doesn't have the cleanest
record. Sorry. I think I said George W. I meant George H.W. Bush, who was the better of the two on balance. But then, you know, Clinton, you know, expanded NATO.
Friend
and,
of the pod,
Kosovo, and it was kind of over at that point. Yeah.
Well, he also ended defense conversion. I mean, like basically Sam Nunn and Colin Powell really nailed him on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And that made him afraid to do anything with defense conversion, which as an essay in a volume I edited, Rethinking U.S. Foreign Policy, goes into like what was actually the political economy of the 1990s? Because Bill Clinton goes in and he's like, we're going to defense convert. We won the Cold War. Right. We don't need to do this anymore. And that, I think if I recall correctly, is basically done by 1995. So there's like a 2-year period where the United States thought that maybe it could reduce its global basing posture and its defense industrial base and its defense spending. And it ends almost immediately. So that's,
I mean,
me
everything that he wanted to do going in was done by 1994 by the midterm. And he was completely, he was a different president from that point on.
Oh, you know what? You know, the other thing that's happened since we spoke is Jimmy Carter died. What's your take on him foreign policy?
Well, I think, Bob, this is where we should turn to you, actually. And I was going to, I was actually going to save this for after the break, but just to get your take or your thoughts on Jimmy Carter would be be great.
We'll give him a taste and then maybe we'll break after that. I mean, first of all, I think one reason, you know, such a huge deal is being made of this. I mean, he is a president who died. That's always significant. But like I just turned on NPR. It's like live coverage of the funeral and everything. And I guess they do that all the time. Anyway, I think
they do. Yeah.
I guess there is justifiably, I think, an awareness of the contrast between a Carter and a Trump in terms of just sheer decency, you know? And that's like an old-fashioned word. I have not spent much of my life complaining about indecency, believe me. Many forms of it I'm actively in favor of. But, you know, it really is a word that captures a lot of what drives me crazy about Trump. He's just not a decent human being. In many senses of that word, Carter,
but is Obama with his kill list a decent human being? This is what drives me mad. Like Obama, every Tuesday would look at the kill list. I mean, what if you run the imperial state? I think it's worth asking to what degree you can be a decent human being, and that's what I would say about Jimmy Carter. And this is basically
you can define it strictly enough to exclude all presidents and all human beings if you want, but
I think there are
gradations. I mean, and as far as Carter, you know, he was a conscientious look. Of course, he's behind it all is a lot of raw ambition. He became president. Of course there is. And of course, people who worked for him can tell stories about how he wasn't always a Sunday school teacher. But, you know, he really, you know, he was kind of, I would say, a serious Christian in the sense that he really worked hard to abide by what he saw as like the rules of the Christian life. And I just respect people who take morality seriously. Trump does not. He is not in any sense a moral human being. And I would contend. And so that's the big contrast. I mean, as for that, it's the first thing that comes to my mind. And I think it's a lot of people. It struck a lot of people, maybe without them articulating it in exactly that way. You know, his foreign policy. You know, I just learned that there, I only for the first time read up on kind of the intramural struggle before he appointed his people over who the people would be. And apparently George Ball was in running for Secretary of State.
It said it's big.
Well, it was big started off as National Security Advisor.
And Cyrus Vance was the Secretary.
Who, you know, I don't really know that much about him.
Well, I mean, what do you think of, okay, so here's the argument against Carter. Basically, introduce neoliberalism and end the détente. So that's the argument against Carter from the historian's perspective. I think pretty much everyone likes his post-presidency.
Well, wait, end the détente in the sense of doing the Afghanistan intervention or launching that? Spig
was very, very anti-Soviet.
This is the problem.
And did basically did everything he could to basically bring détente to the end, setting the stage for the second Cold War of Ronald Reagan of the early 1980s.
Yeah, no, I mean,
that's Vig criticism of him.
Vig was in some ways, I think, a very smart and even wise guy. I mean, wise in the good sense. You know, if you listen to some of the things he said after 9/11, some of the things he warned against Brzezinski, he was smart. He said, like, look, here's what's going to happen. Every country around the world is going to convince us that the local insurgency they're dealing with is part of the global war on terror, and they're going to suck us into it, which is exactly what happened.
And we fell for it hook, line, and sinker.
But he did, perhaps because of his Polish heritage, I don't know, he did have, you know, Jimmy Carter also gets credit for the phrase inordinate fear of communism. Well, unfortunately, Zbigniew had it, at least when it assumed the form of Soviet communism.
He fucking hated communism. I mean,
but he had a thing about the Soviet. Yeah, I mean, remember the Carter years on the China front. This is when various policies that are now being questioned by China hawks kind of took shape.
China policy comes out of out of Carter's administration. Sure.
But even that was
a strategic move against the Soviets, right? I mean, to cozy up to China. That's
what I'm saying. Zbigniew had a bee in his bonnet about the Soviets, and that, I think, warped the whole thing.
So that's the verdict of the presidency. Yeah. Zbigniew wrote that book in the 50s. I'm sure you both have read it, Totalitarianism, I believe, with Carl Friedrich. It's really out there. Mm-hmm. It's a really out there book that basically says, if I recall, I haven't read it in probably a decade, basically the Soviet Union is Nazi Germany, which wasn't like a very accurate or useful way to approach them, particularly when you're in office. So, I mean, like, I think, again, if you're in charge of the imperial death machine, it's going to be hard to be a decent president. That's just the fact of the matter. It's just the truth. How many decent Roman empires are there? Roman emperors. It's just like not possible. And people really get mad at that. But to me, it's actually like it kind of absolves all the presidents. Just they're victims of their own ambition.
You can judge them on their post-presidency then with... You know,
and Carter's
Carter
much better.
The only one, really. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I think that
unless
does
you
want reflect...
unless you really appreciate Barack Obama's Spotify lists, I guess.
That's his Netflix deal. That's the thing I like the most. His millions of dollars Netflix.
He's narrating nature documentaries now. That's good for
well,
him.
Well, I think, you know, when you ask, a year and a half ago, was Barack Obama's time better? Would it have better been spent engineering, you know, some situation where Biden is not the nominee and neither is Kamala Harris, you know, he could have done that, or he could have hung out with Bruce Springsteen.
He kneecapped a shift in the Democratic Party.
That's five years ago.
He said, yeah, but that is responsible for basically a lot of what's going on.
Yeah, but
now.
My big complaint about Obama is that it was... And I was saying this at the time, okay? I was saying this like more than a year ago. I was saying Obama should be the guy who's orchestrating the fucking coup that gets Biden off the ticket and doesn't let Kamala on. I said exactly that. And what's he doing? Hanging out with Bruce Springsteen? That's pathetic.
Dude, it used to be celebrities became presidents. Now presidents become celebrities. I mean, it's just a reversal of the culture in like a really dark way.
Presidency is a stepping stone to the thing that
really matters, which is money.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, Trump's a little bit of a throwback in that he was already a celebrity, although I think he views the presidency as a tool just as much as any of these other guys do, not an end in itself.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, should we do the thing where we go into overtime and explain to people that if they don't have access to the rest of the conversation, which is the best part, I've got a lot of insights I've been saving. I don't know about you two, but this is...
I'm chock full of them, yeah.
I've been intentionally saying dumb shit so that the stuff that people pay for will be the best
Fantastic.
Stuff. But anyway, if they are subscribers to either American Prestige or the Non-Zero Newsletter, they get access to what's about to happen after the... paywall falls,
and they also get a discount on subscribing to the other newsletter.
If as a paid subscriber to either, you go to the post that represents this this particular episode, which will be at the Substack Non-Zero thing, or at your URL, you will find, and I'm gonna give you a chance to tell us what that is. But you will find a button you can click to get the discount to the other subscription. But and where do people, what do they Google to make sure they get to your page where they can do that?
AmericanPrestigePod.com should take you where you need to go.
Okay. All right. So thanks to everybody who's stuck with us this far. And certainly those who will be with us in.
But if you're not, if you're not a paid subscriber, the thanks is only but so much. It's limited.
Yeah, it's very limited from my perspective.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually, I meant to say thank. Yeah. I didn't mean to say thanks. Thanks.
There you go. Yeah.
We extend our thanks.
There's one thank for.
Yeah.
For
the split amongst all of you.
Yeah, all three of us have mustered a single thank. Anyway, you can also just regular subscribe, but we prefer, of course, the kind of support that'll make you sleep better at night for your sake. All right. So we're headed into overtime.